The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 16th, 2018. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, basically because Michael decided that he needed to catch an early flight to wherever he's going, we've pre-recorded today, last-minute executive decision, but we have a great show for you. It is the beginning of our vacation week, and we have solid blockbuster shows. On today's program, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, both professors from Harvard University, on how democracies die. An interesting conversation, one which is relevant even if Donald Trump didn't exist in this country. It is a fascinating look into how democracies sort of fade away bit by bit. And it used to be, back in the day, it was pretty simple. All that would happen is the United States would decide that a country was not providing the business opportunity for American corporations. And so we'd send the CIA in to influence their elections and to, if we had to, maybe take somebody out. And then you'd get a military coup, and that was that. But now it just seems like the world is getting a lot more complicated, right, Matt?
The old solutions no longer apply.
That's true. So things have changed, and it's a fascinating conversation with Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. And then are we going to have a Matt pick?
Yes.
Oh, my God, Matt. I'm watching that. You going to get – I'm going to buy you for your birthday.
What?
I'm going to buy you a new T-shirt just because every time you wear that, Matt is wearing his, like, off-white T-shirt that has this huge red stripe down the side. That looks like it's a. It looks like it's meant to be that way. Are you going to model it now? It looks like it's meant to be that way, and it turns out it's just a stain from a cheap backpack that he would wear on his shoulder in the rain, right?
Yeah, yeah. It was a cheap laptop bag. That was like the third time I wore the shirt, though.
But not in the rain.
No, it was the first time I wore it in the rain.
And you still proudly wear that shirt. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, hey, I don't waste T-shirts, even basic ones.
No, you can't get away with that at my age, but I guess the kids today. It actually does look like, that's a cool shirt, man. Where did you get that?
Exactly. It's the artist aesthetic.
All right, so sit back, enjoy Levitsky and Ziblatt on how democracies die. On Monday, you do not want to miss this. An extended, and all these interviews are a little bit longer than normal. Talking to Daniel Ellsberg on his latest book. You want to check that out. We have a great week for you next week. Shane Burley, Sam Rosenfeld, and Avi Chomsky on the development of the concept of undocumented, of illegal aliens, more or less. But that's all for next week. For today, how democracies die. Quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome both to the program, Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt. They are both professors from Harvard University and authors of How Democracies Die. Welcome to the program, Stephen and Daniel.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
All right. So just so that our audience is clear, Stephen, you have focused on Latin America, and Daniel, you have focused on Europe. In the context of democracies and how they die, let's just start with the concept, Stephen, with what do we mean by democracy?
Oh, by democracy, I mean pretty simple or standard measure used by political scientists, which is a political system, political regime in which elections are free and fair, in which all or nearly all adults can vote, suffrage is universal, and in which civil liberties, the rights of free speech, of press, of protest, of association, are systematically protected. So that's it's a pretty minimalist definition of democracy.
Okay.
But by that measure, there are several dozen democracies in the world today.
And Daniel, let's talk about how the deaths of democracy, because you have both examples from Latin America and in Europe, how that process has seemingly evolved over the course, I guess, of the 20th century.
Yeah, that's a good starting point. I mean, so really, the way democracies have died has changed over the course of the 20th century. Really, with the onset of mass democracy beginning in the early 20th century, during the Cold War, when democracies died, they usually died via military coup. And so, in our book, we have an account of the number of democracies and how they've died during the Cold War period. 3/4 of democracies that died by military coup. After the end of the Cold War, partly because democracy and elections became more widespread, now the main way that democracies die is via elections, which sounds kind of counterintuitive, but really what happens in this second pathway to democratic collapse is leaders are elected, but then once being elected, even though having some democratic legitimacy, dismantle democratic institutions from within or kind of chip away at democratic institutions. And democracies on the second path, democratic death happens in a much less visible and immediate way.
And so, Stephen, are there, are there regional differences in the way that this goes down? Are there differences or, I guess, consistencies in terms of how old the democracy is? What are the factors that cut across, whether it's in Latin America or in Europe or, maybe North America, but let's not get there quite yet. I mean, what are the similarities of the contexts?
Well, the pattern that Daniel just pointed to, this sort of electoral path to democratic breakdown, is found cross-regionally. So you see this in Latin America. In Latin America, there have been almost, outside of Haiti, almost no coups in the last generation. It's been no successful coups. Coups have almost disappeared. So it's almost invariably the electoral road. That's also true. There have been a handful of coups in Africa. There's a coup in Thailand a few years ago. There's obviously a coup in Egypt a few years ago. But this pattern of an elected president or prime minister dismantling democratic institutions within is found in every region of the world. Wherever there is breakdown, that has become the dominant mode. Now, age of democracy matters a lot. There's a lot of evidence that the older a democracy is, the more likely it is to survive, the less likely it is to break down. So breakdown is much more common in new fragile regimes, say in Africa, the former Soviet Union, than it is obviously in Europe or even in Latin America. So having an old democracy is a benefit. Older democracies are harder to kill.
And so, Daniel, why do you think it is, or why do both of you think it is, or do you have opinions as to why coups have become less fashionable?
Yeah, I think, part of the answer, we probably both have something to say on this, but I think part of the answer is certainly with the collapse of communism in the early 1990s, elections became the main mode of organizing politics. I mean, the kind of defeat of fascism and the defeat of communism meant that there was elimination of alternative models of political organization, really coherent models. And so, especially in the early 90s, there was talk of the end of history and so on. And so countries adopted this as it was really the only game in town, so to speak. But, early on in the 90s, it already, though, became clear that countries were adopting elections that weren't necessarily democratic, and sort of, you know, at the impetus of the United States, you know, which was promoting democracy around the world, or, you know, promoting elections around the world, the European Union, which was doing something similar in Eastern Europe and making this a condition of joining the European Union, even countries that weren't really planning on joining the European Union to be members of NATO and so on, there was real international pressure to adopt elections. And so once this became the main format, both just it was the, you know, the zeitgeist in a way, as well as pressure coming from powerful countries, democratic countries, this just became the way of organizing politics. But, you know, very quickly, I think it became clear that just having elections wasn't going to be enough.
And Stephen, I mean, is that consistent with your thinking? And I wonder if the demise of the Soviet Union basically took, you know, one of those options off the table. We can alienate, with two superpowers that are willing to perhaps intervene or to provide some type of legitimacy for my government as, you know, I'm a general. I've got those two options.
It took both options off the table. It took the communist or sort of pro-Soviet single party model off the table, but it also took off the table the U.S.-backed military dictatorship, or U.S.-backed strongman, of which there were many in the world, as you know, all the way through the late 1980s. So both of those things have become less legitimate, both internationally and at home. I mean, it's not just the international system. In a good part of the world, certainly in my part of the world, Latin America, vast majority of citizens think that some kind of electoral regime is the most appropriate form of government. Coups are pretty widely rejected in every country in Latin America.
So, and let's start with Latin America. I mean, is there also, you say that there is a correlation between a young democracy and obviously less mature institutions and their, I guess, vulnerability to a demise of democracy there. Are there also qualities about the public that are consistent?
I mean, there are lots of correlations. There's a really robust correlation between the wealth of a society and the likelihood that democracy will survive. Now, scholars disagree a lot about why that's the case, whether it's some argue that it's the size of the middle class. Some argue that it's easier to reduce inequality if you've got wealth in society. Many people point to the strength of civil society. I personally think that's very important. Wealthier societies are likely to have stronger independent organizations that can resist authoritarian power grabs. But clearly, middle-income countries and upper-middle-income countries, whether it's called Southern Europe or South America, compared to, say, much of Sub-Saharan Africa, wealthier societies are more likely to sustain democracy. Now, that's not a perfect correlation. There are many very poor democracies in the world, Benin, Ghana, Bolivia. But by and large, middle-income countries sustain democracy more frequently.
And Daniel, let's get to now let's turn a little bit towards this country. There is a belief that we are unique in our love for democracy, and maybe that's just a function of how long theoretically, I mean, or some would say that we've been a democracy, although I think you have something to say to that as well. What of this uniqueness of America? I mean, is there any evidence to bear that out, that our population has a greater, deeper love of democracy than any other?
Well, I think I don't think the U.S. is unique. I think it's true that, you know, as Steve has just said, the older democracy is, the greater the category of analysis that analysts often use. Will still say there's higher levels of democratic capital. You know, people are invested in the institutions, politicians, citizens are invested in the institutions. This is what they're used to. So I think any old democracy, there's going to be attachment to those institutions, and that's part of the reason older democracies last longer. you know, whether the U.S. is really the oldest democracy in the world, which is a phrase that's often thrown around, that's not quite right. I mean, it depends, you know, how you're, you know, coding the beginning of American democracy, but certainly it wasn't founded as a democracy and arguably really wasn't even a full democracy until 1964, 65 with the Voting Rights Act, in which enfranchisement was extended to blacks in the south of the U.S. And so really until that point, the U.S. was not really a full-blown democracy. So I think that's one point, is that the recency of American democracy is actually something that we sometimes, you know, overlook. So that's one point. The second point, though, is that as in any democracy, the U.S., you know, there certainly is a strong strand of democratic attachment to democratic institutions, as in all countries, but there's also a subcurrent of authoritarianism, I would argue, in American political culture. That's something we often overlook, but that goes back just in the 20th century, and in our book we recount this a bit, you know, starting with Henry Ford, who was considered running for president, and a famous anti-Semite quoted in Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler, you know, who was considered running for president, Huey Long, the senator and governor from Louisiana, Joe McCarthy in the 1950s, George Wallace in the 1960s. These are figures that were not just obscure figures. These were figures in Gallup poll data going back to the 1930s show really generally garnered around 30% approval ratings in opinion surveys. And so there's always been a strand, I would argue, and we make this case in the book, of Americans who, you know, don't have a necessarily, you know, who don't, democracy maybe not the top priority. And so really the challenge for any political system is, since there's never going to be consensus, full consensus, is to think about how these kinds of forces can be kept at bay and not, you know, sort of take over a political system. So that's really the kind of the way, a different way of thinking about this.
Yeah, and let's move to that, Stephen, because, and I would add, and, you know, we certainly talked about on this program that Bob Altmaier has done extensive research, or did for over about 30 years, and came up with the number that 25% of North Americans are right-wing authoritarians in terms of their desire to follow. And there's certainly been, like you say, there's substantiation to that in terms of what we see through polls and whatnot. So let's talk, Stephen, about both the alliances that allow an authoritarian leader to ascend and the gatekeeping that is supposed to keep that out, which I guess paradoxically is also fairly anti-democratic.
It is. You know, modern democracy is not just about what the majority wants. Modern democracy is about protecting the rights of everybody and protecting the and constraining the power of elected rulers. So, yes, there is, you know, democracy is a mix of features. So we argue that just about any democratic society around, certainly ours, as we just said, you can find from time to time, actually quite frequently, demagogues floating around, authoritarian figures, populists who may have authoritarian inclinations, who gain quite a bit of public support. That is not that's not just something you see in Latin America. It's not just something you see in the United States. You see it quite frequently. So part of, and particularly when times are hard. And so the key, really, we find, and we're not certainly the first to argue this, we draw a lot on the political scientist Juan Linz, the late Juan Linz, who taught at Yale for many years. A crucial element of protecting democracy is keeping these guys out, keeping these guys as far away from power as possible. These guys who may get that get the support of that 25% of right-wing authoritarians. How do you keep them out of office? And the key role for us is mainstream political parties. Mainstream political parties at the center-right, center-left must systematically keep these guys out. Not align with them, not support them, not nominate them, not put them on their party lists, not bring them into Congress. Keep them out. That is a responsibility of political parties, and that's why we argue that party leaders have this sort of gatekeeping function. There shouldn't be a law keeping these guys out. We're not calling for banning certain candidates, but political leaders, our mainstream political parties, have a responsibility on their own to make sure, okay, this guy is not fully committed to democratic rules of the game. We're not going to nominate him. We're not going to praise him publicly. We're not going to appear at rallies with him. We're going to keep him at arm's length. We argue that and so we've got in one of our chapters we look at several examples of both success and failure at that in Europe in the interwar periods. The failure cases are well known, Italy, Germany, both of those cases, mainstream center-right or right-wing parties aligned with fascists, with authoritarians, and helped to legitimize them, helped to open the door to the political system to them. In other cases, Belgium, Finland, right-wing parties did a better job of keeping autocrats out. We argue that in the United States, and there are all sorts of problems and limitations with the way we used to nominate our candidates in the convention system, and we're not defending that system, and we're certainly not calling for a return to that system, but the old smoke-filled rooms actually did a very good job, a consistently good job, of gatekeeping, of keeping demagogues out of office. So there was no way that Henry Ford was ever going to get the nomination of the Democratic Party. He knew that. That's one of the reasons he didn't run. George Wallace, when he was at his most dangerous, knew that he could not get the Democratic Party nomination, ran as an independent. Huey Long obviously was assassinated before he could run for president, but he was not going to get the Democratic nomination in 1936. And so what that parties in the 20th century did a pretty good job of gatekeeping. Now, the primary system that we've adopted post-1972 is much more democratic. It's much more open. There are many, many positives to that. But it limits the gatekeeping capacity of party leaders, and that sort of opens up the possibility that a demagogue can get the nomination.
Does it? I mean, Daniel, does that limit the capacity of leaders to gatekeep, or does it rely on them as individuals and have more political exposure for them because there's no structural barriers?
So you mean with the shift to the post-1972 system, you're saying you're saying does that?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I mean, well,
because Paul Ryan, if we're going to use this, if we can agree that that Donald Trump has these tendencies, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell had plenty of occasion and certainly the ability and the capacity to stand up and say, like, I'm voting for Hillary Clinton, you know, and but they didn't have the structural protection of, say, even the superdelegates, which I think are problematic, but or the structural protection of simply saying, like, oh yeah, no, we control some of these caucuses, you didn't get it, you know, they actually had direct exposure.
Yeah, so there's two points there. One is that having the organizational apparatus and having control of the process, certainly in the procedures in place to keep these sorts of figures out of power in the selection of candidates, certainly is helpful. So having superdelegates, you know, had the Republican Party had superdelegates, it's not clear Donald Trump would have run. Maybe he would have thought it was implausible to begin with, or maybe had he run, he wouldn't have won because it would have been easier for party leaders to kind of rally around, I don't know, who knows, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio or something. And the whole dynamic would have been totally different. So that's the first point. That said, and we also really, you know, clearly make this case in the book, even without those instruments in place, as you point out, you know, politicians could have, leading Republican politicians could have endorsed Hillary, for instance. And so we have a chapter called The Great Republican Abdication, which really the main point there is to say that even, you know, even after winning the nomination, even after Trump won the nomination, Republicans could have actually, Republican elected officials could have endorsed Hillary Clinton. You know, some remained silent. Many ended up essentially siding with Trump. And when we make this case, people will often say, well, this seems kind of naive, or, you know, is Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell really going to come out and endorse Hillary Clinton? But, you know, what's striking is actually we don't have to look very far for evidence of this actually happening. I mean, looking to other countries is useful in this regard. So in the book, we recount the story of how Macron, the current French president, came into office. And, you know, one of the things that happened there was in the first round of the presidential election, which is kind of similar to our primaries in a way, François Fillon, who was the conservative center-right candidate, didn't make it out of the first round. It was kind of a shock to everybody. And so you had Marine Le Pen and Macron, two people not affiliated with any party, really, in the second round. And there was some discussion, will Fillon endorse Le Pen, who he's in some ways ideologically closer to, or will he endorse Macron, who, although in certain ways non-ideological, had been a cabinet minister in the previous socialist government. And in fact, Fillon endorsed Macron, and a significant portion of his voters went to Macron, and this made a difference in the election. And so, in fact, it is, you know, maybe it's easier in that case because it's not, you know, Le Pen was not exactly identical, the same party. But this took some political courage and some, you know, foresight about what might happen had he not done this. And this is something that was certainly lacking on the part of our Republican leaders. So in this sense, you know, Republicans and politicians of all sorts, I mean, this is the lesson of Long Lens, need to put their democracy in front of party at some point, some key points. I mean, most usually, you know, we're political scientists. We understand the way the world works is politicians are hard-boiled. They make political calculations out of self-interest. But every once in a while in politics, there comes a moment where one has to kind of depart from narrow self-interest to think about more long-term, what's for the good of the democracy? What's the right way to behave?
Stephen, does the existence on the right of such an enormous infrastructure and money in the form of, like, essentially the Koch brothers and their network, does that make it harder for Republican Party leaders? I'm certainly not letting them off the hook here, but I mean, is that the dynamic that made that basically boxed them in here, where they had I don't know if I would call it an ideological flank, but they certainly were flanked by a force that has been growing because of the enormous amount of money that has been filtering into the Republican Party outside of the party apparatus.
Right. I mean, I think that's one of two big forces that have kind of contributed to the hollowing out of the Republican Party. Big money is certainly part of the story, although we have to keep in mind that big money was largely against Trump during the primaries, right? The Koch brothers were not pro-Trump during the primaries.
They weren't pro-Trump, but they had built, essentially, you know, I think they had stripped the Republican Party of its dominance in, you know, structurally, it seems to me, on the right.
I think they, combined with the rise of both social media and this sort of extreme partisan media, both AM radio and this set of AM radio personalities, and obviously Fox News, have both contributed. But the point that you make, I think, is right on, which is that there really is no Republican Party leadership anymore. There is no Republican Party establishment. You'll recall well that after the 2012 election, the Republican Party leadership called for an autopsy of the party's defeat. That autopsy, if you read it, looks a little bit like the things that we call on the Republican Party to do in the final chapter of our book, which is that the Republican Party needs to become a more diverse party to operate in 21st century United States. It cannot continue to be a party of old Christian white men. The thing is that there was no party leadership that could impose that vision on the party. It doesn't exist. It's been completely hollowed out, which is very, very problematic. It means that even though the Republican Party can win elections, in important senses, it has become a very weak party. It's a party that is easily and really thoroughly penetrated on one hand by big money, and on the other hand by Fox News and other right elements of the media.
Well, Daniel, and Daniel, I know you have to jump at one point and do when you need, but I want to let you introduce this element, and we can continue it with Stephen. Is this dynamic of race? Because you lay out basically the pattern, the ebb and flow, maybe that's not the right word, but the pendulum swing on race, and that this is in many ways the engine for the type of polarization we have now. And I have to say that it reminded me of a book, I think it was Carol Anderson's White Rage, where she outlines every time there is some type of social movement for black folk in this country, the backlash comes in post Reconstruction, rise of the KKK, you know, I mean, on and on. We can see this, and you build on that in some way, maybe not consciously, but
yeah, no, that's right. That's really, I mean, we understand the current moment of polarization. So all of the factors that Steve just pointed to certainly make it more difficult for the Republican Party to constrain these large social pressures pushing the Republican Party to the right. But really the engine of this change in many ways is backlash and, to the democratization of the United States in the mid-1960s that we talked about. And so we really argue that a few things happened beginning in the 1960s. One, with the enfranchisement of African Americans and the democratization of America, you had the movement of white Democrats to the Republican Party. You had the movement of Democrats to the Republican, of African Americans to the Democratic Party. And then beginning really in the early 70s, but really it's reaching its peak, you know, beginning in the 1980s, the movement of evangelical conservative Christians, who had been evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, to the Republican Party. And so it's a kind of slow moving process. At the end of this story, really beginning in the 1990s, you have two types of political parties. One which is the Republican Party, which is predominantly, not exclusively, but predominantly a white Christian party, and the Democratic Party, which is a very diverse party of seculars and urban seculars and kind of multi-ethnic party. And so in many ways, you have these two very different communities of identity, which regard each other with increasing suspicion and dislike. I mean, opinion surveys show that Republicans and Democrats fear each other. And we really think being pushed primarily by the Republican Party, being pushed further and further to the right because of this narrowing of its core constituency in this increasingly diverse society, you have a radicalization of politics, a polarization, which then in turn undermines the kind of key norms, because it's much harder to sustain norms. One of the key norms we talk about that has helped sustain American democracy is a norm of mutual toleration, where right. political parties and political competitors treat each other as rivals rather than enemies. And this kind of changing polarization has helped undermine that.
You want an environment where, say, a president doesn't, joke around about the other party being treasonous because they didn't clap at a State of the Union, right. for instance, let's say.
Could I add a couple points to what Daniel said?
Please.
I do have to jump off the line here,
okay.
I'm sorry to say. It's been great talking, Sam, and I'm sorry, and I'll leave Steve to finish the job.
All right, that's fine. Thank you, Daniel. I appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay, all right, bye-bye.
So, Steve, continue.
I completely agree that, sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, and I want to get to forbearance as well, since mutual
okay.
toleration
sure.
is, but why don't you, but respond.
So what, I agree completely with what Daniel just said, and I also agree that there have been numerous periods of white backlash across American history. What's a little bit different, or what's somewhat new, I think the only real comparison is the South during the Reconstruction period. What's new about this period is, one, white Christians are in this transition from being an electoral majority and a socially dominant group in the society to losing that status, losing that majority and losing that status. And that is a deeply threatening process. That was not true. Even in the 1960s, there was a heck of a racial backlash that manifested in the rise of George Wallace and others. But even then, the white Christian majority was not imperiled. Now it is, and I think it's even more intense as a result. The second thing, the second difference, and a big difference from the 60s, is that it's now partisan. White Christians are now concentrated in a single party. In previous periods, whether it's the 50s, 60s, 20s, 30s, these right-wing authoritarians that you mentioned earlier were distributed somewhat evenly across the parties. In fact, most of them at periods in our history were Democrats, were Southern Democrats. In the backlash of the late 60s and 1970s, you had backlash in both parties. And now it is concentrated in one party, so the fight has become partisan, and that in that way it's pervading our institutions in a way that it didn't necessarily in the 60s and 70s.
That's interesting, because so you're basically saying the racial divide has aligned with a political partisan divide, and that has
right, and that's
and
so,
in
right.
the other contextual issues has brought us to where we are, and I think that's.
And that makes for a much more intense polarization, right? In the 60s and 70s, Democrats and Republicans disagreed about lots of things, disagreed about taxes, spending, foreign policy, but they were both
the races were equally distributed on some level.
Right. On things like God and race, they were equally distributed. Exactly.
All right. So Daniel, before he left, spoke of the concept of mutual toleration, where the I guess the level of competition between the parties had a ceiling, where it was like, okay, we will not cross these lines because we want this stuff to exist, you know, when we return to power on some level.
Right.
Speak to about forbearance, because I mean, they're more or less, I mean, how is forbearance really that much difference from mutual toleration, or is forbearance, mutual toleration, almost a subset of that forbearance?
I think they're intimately related, because again, mutual toleration is the willingness to say both publicly and privately that even though you disagree with the other side, even though you may even really dislike the other side and compete intensely with the other side, you recognize that they are equally patriotic, that they love the country as much as you do, and that they do not pose an existential threat. In other words, they're rivals. They may be bitter rivals, but they're not the enemy. And once that is lost, once our partisan opponents become viewed as an existential threat, as the enemy, as maybe anti or un-American, we've seen that kind of discourse a lot in the last 10 or 15 years. Once that happens, politicians are tempted, in fact, they're strongly motivated to abandon forbearance. Forbearance is the willing self-restraint in the exercise of power, willingness not to exploit the letter of the law in ways that violate or eviscerate the spirit of the law. So it's the use of restraint in the exercise of our political power, and that's a hard thing. It's actually a rare thing, but it's crucial to the functioning of our pretty elaborate system of checks and balances. But when parties view the other side as the enemy, as dangerous, as treasonous, as unpatriotic, then they are strongly tempted to use any means necessary to keep the other side out. And any means necessary means abandoning forbearance. That's how the two are related.
How do you recover that? Because from my perspective, this forbearance was long gone. You know, maybe in the 90s. Maybe it was even before then. I mean, you know, we've had instances where Nixon ruined the Paris peace talks, where Ronald Reagan arranged for Americans to be held captive for an extended period of time in Iran, perhaps. This forbearance, how do you get it back? Because it seems to me that the only way that you can encourage politicians to exercise forbearance is to make them suffer the lack of it on both sides. Do you have a different idea about that?
A couple of points. I mean, first of all, I'm not sure that forbearance has been long gone for a long time. No society is free of constitutional hardball, which is how we describe the absence of forbearance.
Okay.
Our politicians, our parties have never been perfect in the maintenance of forbearance. But one way to tell whether the norm of forbearance exists is when it's violated, is it a scandal? And I would argue that the behavior of Nixon and Reagan were viewed as scandalous. And these days, increasingly, it's not. What I consider one of the most egregious violations of the norm of forbearance in recent history, the Senate's denial of President Obama's right to fill a vacancy in the Supreme Court, was not seen as a terrible scandal.
Right.
It was by Democrats, obviously. So I think there has been a slow erosion of norms. I think it really picked up in the 1990s. I think Newt Gingrich was one of the first politicians who realized that abandoning mutual toleration and that abandoning forbearance there was a constituency for that in the Republican Party, and that it could be an electoral winner. you clearly saw it in the partisan impeachment of Clinton. But we argue there's been a relatively gradual erosion since maybe the 80s, certainly the 90s.
And certainly,
how do you get it back?
How do we get it back? That's been aided and abetted, it seems to me, by a press that's been a little bit asleep at the wheel, right? I mean, I think the Democrats, frankly, I mean, President Obama was not aggressive enough, it seems to me, in exploiting what what McConnell was doing in terms of Merrick Garland. And because it was Merrick Garland, he was that Obama could have been more aggressive in this, you know, that he could have dropped Garland and said, okay, now I'm going to start to nominate a series of people. I mean, there were things he could have done to be more aggressive about it. He didn't do it. But also there was a failure. There was also a failure of the press to sort of say, like, hey, this is really off the wall. What's going on here?
I think you're right. I think one of the reasons may be that, and this is part of what we're trying to do in the book, is that forbearance and also mutual toleration, but particularly forbearance, is not something that we talk about much in politics. The informal, the unwritten rules of politics are not something that people are necessarily very aware of or pay much attention to. And, you know, what the Republicans did with Garland was legal. The impeachment of Clinton in 1998 was perfectly legal, and so I think that may, I don't mean to absolve the media at all, but that may explain why a lot of us were kind of slow to respond to what was going on, because it wasn't quite so visible. They weren't breaking the law.
So how does forbearance return? Other than just sort of saying, like, I hope Mitch McConnell wakes up in the morning and says, hey, you know what? I've been not a very good guy.
Let me give you two answers and then come around to where you and I may disagree. Historically, looking at other cases, and this is not a good news story, it's usually been once countries, politicians, polities have fallen into the abyss, or at least have stared directly at the abyss, that they come around and change their behavior. So the Chilean left and right, which abandoned forbearance in the early 1970s, which contributed to the 1973 coup, it was not until at least the Christian Democrats and the left had to live with a decade of Pinochet that they came around to basically building a new way of doing politics in Chile, a much more consensus-oriented politics. That it was, unfortunately, the experience of having to live under a horrendous military dictatorship that pushed the center and the left into a different kind of politics. Sort of a similar story in Spain and Germany post-war. It's losing democracy that leads politicians to change their behavior. Now, slightly happier or slightly more realistic story. I mean, I think we have to get at the root cause of polarization, which, as Daniel pointed out, we think is about this the racialized partisan polarization, which means that. So, how do you do that in the United States? The Republicans must become a diverse party, a more diverse party. I mean, as long as in this society, 2018, in this diverse society, the Republicans remain a party that is 90% or almost entirely white Christian, they are going to be prone to extremism. They're going to be prone to white nationalism, a polarizing, dangerous white nationalism. So I think ending this norm erosion requires that we reduce polarization, which requires, I think, that the Republican Party become a diverse party. The other solution, which I have deep objections to, is that the Democrats become a less diverse party, that they sort of push minorities back out and become a white party again. I don't think that's possible, and I think the normative implications of that are horrendous. So the Republicans have to become a more diverse party. Now, you say, well, they're not going to learn their lesson until the Democrats make them pay for it. That's true, and I think all of us who want to defend our democratic institutions in the face of this, of what is looking like an onslaught, and are pained by the kind of sucker punches that Democrats have received in recent years, it's perfectly legitimate and reasonable to think about sort of a tit-for-tat response and what some people call learning how to fight like Republicans. And I got to say, I don't think anybody's got the solution and I'm pretty sure that there's no easy way out. When you're in this spiral of norm erosion, there's no easy choice. I think you're pretty much damned if you do and damned if you don't. So I'm not saying that I'm clear on an easy single bullet solution. But here's why I'm worried about that as a strategy. Looking at democracies that have slid into crisis, that have failed, that have died elsewhere in the world, this sort of erosion of norms rarely ends well. And so reinforcing the erosion of our norms, reinforcing or even accelerating the erosion of our norms, looking at how that process moves forward in other countries, whether it's Spain in the 30s or Chile in the 60s and 70s or Brazil in the 60s, it rarely ends well. And so I can develop this point a little bit more if you want, but I'm very, very wary of accelerating norm erosion.
I mean,
I think the Democrats have an interest in the medium term in avoiding that, because If I can extend on this point,
please,
just a little bit.
Please,
a point that David Frum makes that I agree with is that a lot of the behavior of the Republican Party in recent years, trying to, pursuing voter suppression, the other sort of norm violations that we've seen in recent years, a lot of it is desperation, because the Republicans know that as they are constituted, they're going to have a very, very difficult time winning elections in the medium run. So they're doing everything. They're basically pursuing any means necessary strategy now. The Democrats have a much better horizon in the medium run. You know, as constituted, they're pretty well positioned to win elections in the medium term. And so I think they've got an interest in preserving our democratic institutions so that they can reap the benefits of those of that future. I think the Democrats have a reason to be more farsighted than the Republicans do. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, I understand it makes sense. I'm not sure I agree that the demographics as destiny. I'm not sure that the Democrats, I'm not sure that you're gonna drive votes that way. We're seeing that the more engaged people are with politics, that those numbers for Democrats who want less compromise goes up. And so I'm not convinced that as a political strategy that would work. And I'm also not convinced that it really would make that much of a difference. I mean, it depends on what we're talking about here. But the problem is that fear, it seems to me, has fueled that fear of shifting norms or destroying norms. And it depends on what they are. But that fear, it seems to me, led Barack Obama not to hold George W. Bush to account, and members of his administration to account on a number of issues that were relevant. I mean, the idea, I guess what I'm saying is that sometimes the norms maintenance gets conflated with maintaining an order that isn't necessarily a norm that isn't necessarily good, right? Like, I mean,
a norm or an order?
Well,
I mean, there are lots of norms. So Daniel and I focus on two norms. We're not saying that all norms need to be preserved. In fact, we believe, as most people do, that there are a wide range of norms of that prevent us from moving forward toward a more just society.
So what norms?
Advocating
what are the most
for
important
universal
norms?
Norm preservation.
Right. Okay. So
there
what are the
two specific norms that we say a democracy requires? That's it.
The mutual toleration and the forbearance.
Right. Can't make yes. You cannot make a constitutional democracy work without it.
So okay. So let's just get a little bit more specific here. What happens? I mean, I find it hard to believe that Donald Trump is going to be here for three terms. It's conceivable too, but I it seems to me there's a lot of people still asleep in this country who just have tuned out of this situation and something like, hey, I'm going to extend the term limits or something to that effect is going to wake people up. What concerns mm-hmm. me is like what happens in the mm-hmm. aftermath of this, right? Like the lesson for people in the Republican Party is, okay, we may go out of power for a couple of years, but we're going to come roaring back because there's clearly some pendulum swinging that's going on. We did what we needed to do for our donor base and for, we got our tax cuts and we've dismantled the administrative state to a certain extent. It's going to take a long time to rebuild this stuff relative to like even a George Bush administration, which wreaked its own havoc. But what's to keep the next guy from roaring back? What's to keep Tom Cotton from saying like I'm going to pull a Donald Trump here, except for I'm also much smarter about it?
I mean, there are a couple of different dimensions. Programmatically, I mean, if Republicans I can't stand the idea of picking apart the state, and I think that the Republican tax reform has horrendously negative consequences. So I despise the Republicans' programmatic agenda. But if they win elections, they have the right to pursue it.
Right.
So Tom Cotton wins a presidential election, he can pursue, if he does it legally, a shrinking of the state and the shrinking of and a lowering of taxes. I will oppose it. I'll scream about it.
Oh, well,
but
I'm not
right to do it.
I'm not talking
That's
about
different
the,
from dismantling rules.
Right, right. I mean, but I'm saying by Tom Cotton, I'm saying he follows the path that Trump has, which is the demagoguery, the assault on immigrants and on using race, and just takes it to the next level because he's a little bit smarter in the way that he wields it. I mean, what is, to the extent that Trump is a threat to our democracy, what is the disincentive for the next Republican to not do the same things? I mean, aside from the ideological programmatic stuff.
In reality, the only the strongest, the clearest, the best disincentive is electoral defeat. They have to lose elections. If demagoguery and racism continue to be an electorally viable path, we're in even worse trouble than I think we are today. Our best hope is that it's not an electorally viable path. And I actually think that it's that white nationalism is not in the medium term an electorally viable path in this country, and I hope I'm right. But we're in some serious trouble if the lesson in the medium term for Tom Cotton and whoever comes after Tom Cotton is that you can follow you can pursue a sort of white nationalist demagogic agenda or make that the centerpiece of your platform and win. If that's the lesson, we're in for some serious trouble.
Yes, well, that seems like a harrowing place to end, but maybe
They have to lose. They have to lose, which means that we have to those who believe in our flawed but real democracy have to mobilize and vote against these guys. That's the best arm that we still have.
Stephen Levitsky, co-author of How Democracies Die, of course, with Daniel Ziblatt. Thank you both for coming on. You will pass those thanks on to him for me. Really appreciate your time today.
Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.